do I feel like I've heard this someplace before? And the older he gets, the worse he gets, she went on, obliviously. Even when he was young, he was a hopeless hypochondriac, but now... Believe me, it was a dark day in the universe when the Internet started letting people research their medical symptoms. She might have gone on, she usually did, but at that moment Petey came into the room.
Grandma, he said, can we have the last of that fudge ripple?
What? Before supper? Abby asked.
We're already eating our supper.
Yes, you can have it. And take Heidi when you go, will you? She's sneezing again. It was true that Heidi had started sneezing. A whole fit of sneezes, light but spattery.
Gesundheit, Merrick told her.
What's the trouble, honey bunch? Coming down with something?
She does this all day long, Abby said. You wouldn't suppose sneezing would be such an irritation, but it is.
Petey said, Mom thinks it's on account of she's allergic to Grandma's rugs.
Well, I wouldn't bring her to visit then, poor baby, Merrick said.
She's got to visit. She lives here.
Heidi lives here?
She lives here with us.
You live here?
Yes, and Sammy's allergic too. All night he breathes dramatically.
Merrick looked at Abby. Take Heidi to the kitchen, Petey, Abby said.
Yes, she told Merrick. They've moved in to help out. Isn't that nice?
Help out with what?
Well, just, you know, we're getting older.
I'm getting older, too, but I haven't turned my house into a commune.
To each his own, I guess, Abby sang out merrily.
Wait, Merrick said. Is there something someone's not telling me? Has one of you been diagnosed with some terminal disease?
No, but after Red's heart attack...
Red had a heart attack?
You knew that. You sent him a fruit basket in the hospital.
Oh, Merrick said. Yes, maybe I did.
And I'm not so spry either lately.
This is ridiculous, Merrick said. Two people get a bit wobbly, and their entire family moves in with them? I never heard of such a thing.
Denny cleared his throat.
Actually, he said, Stem is not here on a permanent basis.
Well, thank heaven.
I am.
Merrick looked at him, waiting for him to go on. The others stared down at their laps.
I'm the one who's staying, Denny said.
Stem said, Well, not.
Oh, for God's sake, why is anyone staying? Merrick asked. If your parents are really so decrepit, and I must say I find that hard to believe, they're barely in their 70s, they should move to a retirement community. That's what other people do.
We're too independent for a retirement community, Red told her.
Independent? Bosh! That's just another word for selfish. It's stiff-backed people like you who end up being the biggest burdens.
Stem rose to his feet.
Well, he said, I guess Nora must be fretting about her supper getting cold.
And he stood waiting in the center of the room. Everyone looked at him in surprise.
Finally, Merrick said, Oh, I see. Clear that tiresome woman out of here. She tells too many home truths.
But she was standing up as she spoke, draining the last of her drink as she moved toward the front hall.
I know, she said. I see how it is.
The others rose to follow her.
Here, Merrick said at the door, and she thrust her empty glass at Abby. And by the way, she told Denny, you're supposed to have a life by now. You're only putting things off, scurrying back home on the slightest excuse.
She left, clicking across the porch with a brisk, energetic stride, like someone triumphant in the knowledge that she had set everybody straight.
What is she talking about? Denny asked after a moment.
Abby said,
"Oh, you know how she is.
I can't abide that woman."
Ordinarily, Abby would have tut-tutted, but now she just sighed and headed for the kitchen. The men went into the dining room and settled at the table, none of them speaking, although Red did say as he dropped onto his chair,
"Ah, me."
They waited in a kind of drained silence. From the kitchen they could hear the burble of the little boys' voices and a clatter of utensils. Then Nora emerged through the swinging door, carrying a casserole. Abby came behind with a salad.
"You should see Merrick's leftovers," she told the men. "A smidgen of store-bought pasta sauce in the bottom of a jar, a wedge of brie completely hollowed out inside the rind, and..."
"What else, Nora?" she asked.
"A cold broiled lamb chop," Nora said, setting the casserole on the table.
"A lamb chop, yes, and a Chinese takeout carton of rice and one single solitary pickle in a bottle of scummy brine."
"We should put her in touch with Hugh," Denny said.
"Hugh?" Abby asked.
"Amanda's Hugh. Do not pass go. She could call him before every trip."
"Oh, you're right," Abby said. "They're made for each other."
"He'd tell her he knows a soup kitchen that's dying to have her leftovers, and he'd come by her house and collect them and take them off to the trash."
This made the others laugh, even Nora a little. Red said,
"Oh, now, you folks."
But he was laughing, too.
"What?" Tommy asked. He'd cracked open the door from the kitchen. "What's so funny?"
None of them wanted to say. They just smiled and shook their heads. To a child, they must have looked like some happy, cozy club that only grown-ups could belong to. It took a total of 5 vehicles to carry them all to the beach. They could have managed with fewer, but Red insisted, as usual, on driving his pickup. How else could they bring everything they needed, he always asked. The rafts and boogie boards, the sand toys for the children, the kites and the paddleball rackets and the giant canvas shade canopy with its collapsible metal frame. In the old days, before computers, he used to include the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. So he and Abby made the 3-hour trip in the pickup, while Denny drove Abby's car with Susan in the passenger seat and the food hampers in the rear. Stem and Nora and the 3 little boys came in Nora's car, and Jeannie and Jeannie's Hugh started out separately from their own house with their 2 children, though not with Hugh's mother, who always spent the beach week visiting Hugh's sister in California. Amanda and Amanda's Hugh and Elise traveled on a whole different day, Saturday morning instead of Friday afternoon, since Amanda always had trouble getting away from her law office, and they stayed in a different cottage because Amanda's Hugh couldn't tolerate what he called the hurly-burly. None of the dogs came. They were all boarding at Pen Pals. The house the Whitshanks rented every summer stood right on the beach, a comparatively uncrowded stretch of the Delaware coast. But it wasn't what you'd call luxurious. The walls were tongue and groove, painted a depressing pea soup green. The floorboards were so splintery no one dared go barefoot. The kitchen dated from the 1940s. But it was big enough for all of them, and far homier than the glittering new mansions with giant Palladian windows that had popped up elsewhere along the shore. Besides, Red could always use a few fix-it jobs to keep him occupied. He wasn't a natural vacationer. Even before Abby and Nora had unpacked the food, he had happily catalogued 6 minor household emergencies.
"Will you look at this outlet?" he said, practically dangling by a thread.
And off he went to the truck for his tools, with Jeannie's Hugh not far behind.
"The next door people are back,"
Jeannie called, stepping in from the screen porch. Next door was almost the only house as unassuming as theirs was, and the people she was referring to had been renting it for at least as long as the Whitshanks had been renting theirs. Oddly enough, though, the two families never socialized. They smiled at each other if they happened to be out on the beach at the same time, but they didn't speak. And although Abby had once or twice debated inviting them over for drinks, Red always voted her down. "Leave things as they were," he told her. "Less chance of any unwelcome intrusions in the future." Even Amanda and Jeannie, on the lookout during the early days for playmates, had hung back shyly because the next-door people's two daughters always brought friends of their own, and besides, they were slightly older. So for all these years, 36 now, the Whitshanks had watched from a distance while the slender young parents next door grew thicker through the middle and their hair turned gray, and their daughters changed from children to young women. One summer in the late 90s, when the daughters were still in their teens, it was noticed that the father of the family never once went down to the water, spending the week instead lying under a blanket in a chaise longue on their deck. And the summer after that, he was no longer with them. A muted, sad little group, the next-door people had been that year, when always before they had seemed to enjoy themselves so. But they did come, and they continued to come, the mother taking her early morning walks along the beach alone now, the daughters in the company of boyfriends, who metamorphosed into husbands by and by, and then a little boy appearing, and later a little girl. "The grandson has brought a friend this year," Jeannie reported. "Oh, that makes me want to cry."
"Cry? What for?" Hugh asked her.
"It's the circularity, I guess. When we first saw the next-door people, the daughters were the ones bringing friends. And now the grandson is, and it starts all over again."
"You sure have given these folks a lot of thought," Hugh said.
"Well, they're us, in a way," Jeannie said. But you could see Hugh found that hard to understand. On the Friday that the Whitshanks arrived, only the men and the children went down to the water. The women were busy unpacking and making beds and organizing supper. But by Saturday, when Amanda and her family showed up, they'd all settled into their routine of a full morning on the beach and lunch at the house in their sandy swimsuits, and then afternoon on the beach again. The canvas canopy sheltered the white-skinned Whitshank grown-ups, but the in-laws sat brazenly in the sun. Stem's three little boys challenged the breakers to bowl them over, but then ran away at the last minute, shrieking with laughter, while Stem stood guard at the water's edge with his arms folded. Amanda's Elise, storky and pale in a tutu-like swimsuit, stayed high and dry on a corner of the blanket underneath the canopy, but Susan and Deb spent most of their time diving through the waves. Susan was 14 this summer, Elise's age, but she seemed to have more in common with 13-year-old Deb. Both she and Deb were children still, although Deb was a skinny little thing, while Susan was more solidly built, waistless, and nearly flat-chested, but with something almost voluptuous about her full lips and her large brown eyes. The two of them had a bedroom to themselves this year. Elise used to bunk with them rather than in her parents' cottage, but not any longer. She'd gotten stuck up, Deb and Susan claimed. Alexander was mostly on his own as well, too young for the girls and too sedentary for Stem's boys. Mostly he stayed seated at the water's edge, letting the surf froth up and then ebb around his soft white legs, except for when his father coaxed him into a game of paddleball or a ride on a raft. Elsewhere on the beach, teenagers built giant sand castles, and mothers dipped their babies' bare feet in the foam, and fathers threw frisbees to their children. Seagulls screamed overhead, and a little plane flew up and down the coastline, trailing a banner that advertised all-you-can-eat crabs. Amanda and Amanda's Hugh didn't seem to be getting along. Or Amanda wasn't getting along. Hugh appeared cheerfully unaware. Anything he said to her, she answered shortly, and when he invited her to take a walk on the beach, she said, "No thanks," and turned the corners of her mouth down as she watched him set off on his own. Abby, sitting next to Amanda but outside the canopy, under the sun, said, "Oh, poor Hugh. Don't you think you should go with him?" She was eternally monitoring her daughter's marriages. But Amanda didn't answer, and Abby gave up and went back to her reading. A stack of trashy magazines had been discovered beneath the TV, no doubt left behind by a previous renter, and they had passed through the hands of her granddaughters and then her daughters and ended up with Abby herself, who was leafing through one now and tisking over the silliness. "All this excitement about could so-and-so be pregnant," she told her daughters. "And I don't even know who so-and-so is. I've never heard of her." In her skirted pink swimsuit, her plump shoulders glistening with suntan lotion, and her legs lightly dusted with sand, she looked something like a cupcake. She hadn't ventured into the water at all so far, and neither had Red. In fact, Red was wearing his work shoes and dark socks. Evidently, this was the year when the two of them were declaring themselves to be officially old. "I remember when I first met him. I thought he was a jerk," Amanda told Denny. She must have been referring to Hugh. "I had that apartment on Chase Street with a garbage chute at the end of the hall, and I kept finding bags of garbage just sitting on the floor around the chute, not sent down the way they should have been. And poking out of the bag, I'd see beer bottles and chili cans, things that should have been put in the recycling bin. It made me furious. So one day I taped a sign to a bag, 'Whoever did this is a pig.'" "Oh, Amanda, honestly," Abby said, but Amanda didn't seem to hear her. "I don't know how he knew it was me," she told Denny, "but he must have. He knocked on my door, and he was holding my sign. 'Did you write this?' he said. And I said, 'I most certainly did.' Well, he put on this big charm act. Said he was terribly sorry. It wouldn't happen again. He didn't know the recycling rules, and he hadn't sent the bag down the chute because it wouldn't fit, blah, blah, as if that were any excuse. But I admit, he won me over. You know what, though? I should have paid attention. There it was, all spelled out for me from the beginning. This is a man who thinks he's the only person on the planet. How much clearer could it have been?" "So, now does he recycle?" Denny asked. "You're missing the point," Amanda said. "I'm talking about his nature, the very nature of the man. It's all about what's expedient for him. He's just arranged to sell the restaurant to someone for next to nothing, for a song, merely because he's bored and he wants to go into something new. Can you believe it?" "I thought you approved of the something new," Denny said. "I thought you said it was brilliant." "Oh, I was just being supportive. Besides, it's not the something new I mind. It's the way he goes about getting rid of the old. He didn't even consult me. Just took the very first offer he got because he wants what he wants when he wants it." Abby touched Amanda's arm. She sent a meaningful glance toward Elise, but Amanda said, "What?" and turned away again. And Elise just then stood up in one long, graceful movement and began walking toward the water, as if nothing the grown-ups said could have anything to do with her. "I didn't know that was how you met," Abby said. "That's kind of like a movie, like a Rock Hudson Doris Day movie, where they start out hating each other. I thought you met in the elevator or something." "The man is impossible," Amanda said, as if Abby hadn't spoken.
"You can see why he'd jump at the chance to sell, though," Denny said. "I don't guess it's easy unloading a place that serves nothing but turkey."
"Well, it It's not married to turkey. It could serve other things. And it's got tons of equipment, ovens and such, that are worth a lot of money.
Oh, Abby said. Poor Hugh. Men don't handle failure well at all.
Mom, please. Enough with the poor Hugh.
Want to take a walk, Ab? Red asked suddenly. It wasn't clear whether he'd been listening to what was being said. Maybe he really did feel like a walk just then. At any rate, he heaved himself to his feet and stepped over to give Abby a hand up. She was still shaking her head as they started off down the beach.
"Now they'll have a long talk about what a bad wife I am," Amanda said, watching them go. "Dad walks so slowly these days," Jeannie said. "Look at him. He's so stiff."
"How does he manage at work?" Denny asked her.
"I don't notice it so much at work. It's not as if he does anything physically demanding there anymore."
They watched their parents meet up with Nora, who was returning from a walk of her own. She exchanged a few words with them, and then continued toward Stem and her children, floating ethereally through a group of teenage boys tossing a football at the water's edge. A black tie-on skirt fluttered and parted over her modest one-piece swimsuit, and her dark hair lifted from her shoulders in the breeze. The teenage boys halted their game to follow her with their eyes, one of them cradling the football under his arm.
"The unwitting femme fatale," Denny murmured, and Amanda gave a little hiss of amusement.
"Is Elise having any fun?" Jeannie asked Amanda. "It doesn't seem she's joining in much this year."
"I have no idea," Amanda said. "I'm only her mother."
"I guess ballet has kind of taken her away from things."
Amanda didn't answer. The three of them were silent a moment, their gazes fixed on a nearby toddler in a swim diaper who was pursuing a committee of gulls. The gulls strutted ahead of him at a dignified pace, gradually speeding up, although they pretended not to notice him.
"How about Susan?" Jeannie asked Denny. "Is she having a good time?"
"She's having a great time," he said. "She really likes coming here. These are the only cousins she's got."
"Oh, does Carla not have any siblings?"
"Just an unmarried brother."
Jeannie and Amanda raised their eyebrows at each other.
"How is Carla these days?" Amanda asked after a moment. "Fine, as far as I know."
"Do you see much of her?"
"Nope."
"Do you see anybody?"
"Do I see anybody?"
"You know what I mean. Any women?"
"Not really," Denny said.
And then, just when it seemed the conversation was finished, he added,
"Face it, I'm hardly a catch."
"Why not?" Jeannie asked.
"Well, I kind of come across as a deadbeat. I mean, it's not as if I've been blazing an impressive career path all these years."
"Oh, that's ridiculous. Lots of women would fall for you."
"No," Denny said. "When you think about it, things haven't changed much since the days when parents were trying to marry their daughters off to guys with titles and estates. Women still want to know what you do when they meet you. It's the first question out of their mouths."
"So? You're a teacher. Or a substitute teacher, at least."
"Right," Denny said.
A little girl ran past them toward the water, the granddaughter of the next-door people. Reflexively, Denny and his sisters half turned to watch the next-door people threading from their house to the beach, carrying towels and folding chairs and a styrofoam cooler. They arrived at a spot some 20 feet distant from the Whitshanks. The grown-ups unfolded their chairs and settled in a straight row facing the ocean, while the grandson and his friend went down to where the little girl was bounding into the surf.
"Have we ever found out for sure that they come for just the 1 week?" Amanda asked. "Maybe they're here all summer."
"No," Jeannie said. "We saw them arrive that time, remember, with their suitcases and their beach equipment.
Maybe they stay on then, after we leave.
Well, maybe. I guess they could. But I like to think that they go when we do. They have the same conversation we always have. Next year, should they make it 2 weeks? But by the end of their vacation, they say, oh, 1 week is enough, really. And so they come for the same week, year after year, and 50 years from now we'll be saying, here Jeannie's voice changed to an old lady whine,
oh, look, it's the next door people, and the grandson's got a grandson now.
They brought their lunch today, Denny said. We could check out their menu.
Jeannie said, what if we marched over there right this minute and introduced ourselves?
It would be a disappointment, Amanda said.
How come?
They would turn out to have some boring name like Smith or Brown. They'd work in, let's say, advertising or computer sales or consulting. Whatever they worked in, it would be a letdown. They'd say, oh, how nice to meet you. We've always wondered about you. And then we'd have to give our boring names and our boring occupations.
You really think they wonder about us?
Well, of course they do.
You think they like us?
How could they not? Amanda asked.
Her tone was jokey, but she wasn't smiling. She was openly studying the next-door people with a serious, searching expression, as if she weren't so sure after all.
Did they find the Witshanks attractive? Intriguing? Did they admire their large numbers and their closeness?
Or had they noticed a hidden crack somewhere, a sharp exchange or an edgy silence or some sign of strain? Oh, what was their opinion? What insights could they reveal if the Whitshanks walked over to them that very instant and asked? It was the custom for the men to do the dishes every evening while they were on vacation. They would shoo the women out. Go on now, go. Yes, we know, put the leftovers in the fridge. And then Denny would fill the sink with hot water, and Stem would unfurl a towel. Meanwhile, Jeannie's Hugh, one of those thorough, conscientious types, reorganized the whole kitchen and scrubbed down every surface. Red might carry a few plates in from the dining room, but soon, at the other's urging, he would settle at the kitchen table with a beer to watch them work. Amanda's Hugh wasn't around for this. Her little family ate most of their suppers in town. On their final evening, Thursday, the cleanup was more extensive. Every leftover had to be dumped, and the refrigerator shelves had to be emptied and wiped down. Jeannie's Hugh was in his element.
Throw it out. Yes, that too, he said when Stem held up a nearly full container of coleslaw. No point hauling it all the way back to Baltimore.
The three of them slid a glance toward Red, who shared his sister's horror of waste, but he was thumbing through one of the trashy magazines and he failed to notice.
What's the plan for tomorrow? Denny asked. We leaving at crack of dawn?
Hugh said, well, I should, at least. I've got half a dozen messages on my cell phone.
He meant messages from the college.
Lots of stuff to see to in the dorms.
So, Denny told Stem, that means fall is coming.
Pretty soon, Stem said.
He returned a not quite clean plate to the sink.
You don't want to wait too long to move back home, Denny told him, or the kids will have to switch schools.
Stem was drying another plate. He stopped for a second, but then he went on drying.
They've already switched, he said. Nora registered both of the older boys last week. But it makes more sense for you to move back, now that I'm staying on.
Stem laid the plate on a stack of others.
You're not staying, he said.
What?
You'll be leaving any time now.
What are you talking about?
Denny had turned to look at him, but Stem went on wiping plates. He said,
you'll pick a fight with one of us, or you'll take offense at something,
or one of those calls will come in on your phone from some mysterious acquaintance with some mysterious emergency, and you'll disappear again.
That's bullshit, Denny told him.
Jeannie's Hugh said, Oh, well, now, guys. And Red looked up from his magazine, one finger marking his place.
You just say that because you wish I weren't staying, Denny told Stem.
I'm well aware you want me out of the way. It's no surprise to me.
I don't want you out of the way, Stem said.
They were facing each other squarely now. Stem was gripping a plate in one hand and the towel in the other, and he spoke a little more loudly than he needed to.
God! What do I have to do to convince you I'm not out to get you? I don't want anything that's yours. I never have. I'm just trying to be a help to Mom and Dad.
Red said,
What? Wait.
Well, isn't that just like you? Denny told Stem.
Spilling over with selflessness, holier than God Almighty.
Stem started to say something more. He drew in a breath and opened his mouth. Then he made a despairing noise that sounded like, Ah! And without even seeming to think about it, he wheeled toward Denny and gave him a violent shove. It wasn't an attack, exactly. It was more an act of blind frustration. But Denny was caught off balance. He staggered sideways, dropping the plate he held so that it shattered across the floor, and he tried to right himself but fell anyhow, his head grazing the edge of the table before he landed in a sitting position.
Oh, Stem said. Gosh.
Red stood up, slack-mouthed, with his magazine dangling from one hand. Hugh was hovering in front of the fridge and saying, Guys, hey, guys, and gripping his wash rag in a useless sort of way. Denny began struggling to his feet. His left temple was bleeding. Stem bent to offer him a hand, but instead of accepting it, Denny lunged at him from a half-standing position and butted Stem in the sternum. Stem buckled and fell backwards, slamming against a cabinet. He sat up again, but he looked groggy, and he raised a hand tentatively to the back of his head. All at once, the kitchen was full of fluttering women and shocked, wide-eyed children. There seemed to be a multitude of them, way more than could be accounted for. Abby was saying, What is this? What's happened? And Nora was leaning over Stem, trying to help him up.
Keep him sitting, Jeannie told her. Stem? Do you feel dizzy?
Stem went on holding his head with an uncertain look on his face. Shards of the plate lay all around him. Denny stood backed against the sink. He seemed bewildered more than anything.
I don't know what came over him, he said. He just went from 0 to 60.
Blood was traveling down the side of his face, darkening the olive green of his T-shirt.
Look at you, Jeannie told him. We've got to get you to an emergency room, the two of you.
I don't need an emergency room, Denny said, at the same time that Stem said, I'm okay, let me up.
They both have to go, Abby said. Denny needs stitches, and Stem might have a concussion.
I'm fine, Stem and Denny said in chorus.
Let's at least put you on the couch, Nora told Stem. She didn't seem all that perturbed.
She helped him to his feet, this time without Jeannie's objecting, and guided him out of the room. All the children followed dumbly except for Susan, who was standing very close to Denny and stroking his wrist. Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
What are you crying about? Denny asked her. This is nothing. It doesn't even hurt.
She nodded and swallowed, tears still streaming. Abby put an arm around her and said,
He's okay, honey. Head wounds always bleed a lot.
Out, Jeannie said. Everyone out of the kitchen while I check the damage. Get me the first aid kit, Hugh. It's in the downstairs bathroom. Susan, I need paper towels.
Red had sunk back onto his chair at some point,
but Abby touched his shoulder and said, "Let's go to the living room."
"I don't understand what happened," he told her.
"Me neither, but let's leave Jeannie to take care of things." She helped him up, and they moved toward the door. Only Susan remained. She handed Jeannie a roll of paper towels.
"Thanks," Jeannie said.
She tore off several sheets and dampened them under the faucet. "First, we're going to clean the wound and see if it needs stitches," she told Denny. "Sit down."
"I do not need stitches," he said.
He lowered himself to a chair. She leaned over him and pressed the wad of damp towels to his temple. Susan, meanwhile, sat down in the chair next to his and picked up one of his hands.
"Hmm,"
Jeannie said. She peered at Denny's cut. She refolded the paper towels and dabbed again at his temple.
"Ouch!"
he said.
"Hugh, where's that first aid kit?"
"Coming right up,"
Jeannie's Hugh said as he entered the kitchen. He handed her what appeared to be a fisherman's metal tackle box. Jeannie said, "Go tell the others not to let Stem fall asleep here."
"Leave that,"
because Hugh was stooping to pick up shards of the plate. "We need to make sure he doesn't go into a coma." She had always been the type who grew authoritative in a crisis. Her long black ponytail almost snapped as she flicked it out of her way. Hugh left. As soon as he was gone, Denny said,
"I swear, this was not my fault."
"Really?" Jeannie said.
"Honest. You've got to believe me."
"Susan, find me the Neosporin." Susan raised her eyes to Jeannie's face but went on sitting there.
"Ointment in the first aid kit," Jeannie told her.
She folded the paper towels yet again. They were almost completely red now. Susan let go of Denny's hand to reach for the kit. Her blouse had a brushstroke of blood smeared across one shoulder.
"We were just doing the dishes," Denny said. "Peaceful as you please, then Stem flies off the handle because I say he can move home now."
"Yes, I can just imagine," Jeannie said.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
She tossed the paper towels into the garbage bin and accepted the Neosporin from Susan.
"Hold still," she told Denny.
She applied a dab of ointment. He held still, gazing up at her steadily. She said,
"When are you going to drop all this, Denny?
Get over it. Give it up." "Give what up? He was the one who started it."
"Don't you think everyone's got some kind of injury? Stem himself, for instance? Couldn't I feel jealous, too, if I put my mind to it? Dad favors Stem way over me, even though I'm a really good worker. He's always talking about Stem taking charge of the business someday, as if I didn't exist, as if I couldn't do every single thing a man can do once somebody shows me how."
"But guess what, Denny? The fact is that nobody has to show Stem how. He was just, seems like, born knowing how. He can figure things out without being told. He honestly does deserve to be in charge." Denny made an impatient snorting noise that she ignored.
"Butterfly bandages," she told Susan. "If you can find me some of those, we're in business."
Susan rooted through the first aid kit, which didn't seem well organized. She tossed aside scissors, tweezers, rolls of gauze, a bottle of vinegar for jellyfish stings, and came up with a box of butterfly bandages.
"Great," Jeannie said.
She shook several out onto the table, then picked up one and tore open the wrapping.
"A few of these should do the trick," she told Denny. "Hold still, please."
"It's not his being in charge I mind," Denny said. "I sure don't want to be in charge. It's the dad isn't satisfied with the rest of us, his own three children. You said it yourself. You should be the one taking over the business. You're a witch-shank. But oh no, Dad had to go hunting outside the family for someone."
"He didn't go hunting," Jeannie said. She drew back to study the bandage she had applied, and then she reached for another. He didn't choose to have Stem join the family. It just happened.
All my life, Dad has made me feel I didn't quite measure up, Denny said. Like I'm lame. I'm lacking.
Listen to this, Jeannie. When I was working in Minnesota one summer, I had a boss who thought I had a really good eye. We were putting in cabinets, and I would come up with these design plans that he said were fantastic. He asked if I'd ever considered going into furniture making. He thought I had real talent. Why doesn't Dad ever feel that way?
And then what? Jeannie asked.
What do you mean, what?
What happened with the furniture making?
Oh, well, I forget. I think we moved on to the boring part then, baseboards or something. So I quit, by and by.
Jeannie sighed and collected the bandage wrappings from the table.
Okay, Susan, she said. You can help your dad to the living room now.
But just as Denny was getting to his feet, Stem walked in with Nora close behind. By the looks of him, he'd recovered from the blow to his head. He seemed himself again, only paler and more rumpled.
Denny, he said, I want to apologize.
He is very, very sorry, Nora put in.
I should not have lost my temper, and I want to pay for your string cheese incident T-shirt.
Denny made a little puffing sound of amusement, and Abby, who had come into the room behind them, of course she had to be part of this, falling all over herself to set her family to rights, said,
Oh, Stem, that's no problem. I'm sure we can treat it with OxyClean,
which made Denny laugh aloud.
Forget it, he told Stem. Let's just say it never happened.
Well, that's very generous of you.
Fact is, I'm kind of relieved to find out you're human, Denny said. Till now, I didn't think you had a competitive bone in your body.
Competitive?
Let's shake on it, Denny said, holding out his hand.
Stem said, Why do you say I'm competitive?
Denny let his hand drop. Hey, he said. You just assaulted me for saying I should be the one to help out with Mom and Dad. You don't call that competitive?
God damn, Stem said. Nora said, Oh, Douglas.
Stem socked Denny in the mouth.
It wasn't an expert blow. It landed clumsily, a bit askew, but it was enough to send Denny tumbling back onto his chair. Blood bubbled up instantly from his lower lip. He gave a dazed shake of his head. Abby shrieked, Stop! Please stop! And Jeannie said, Oh, for heaven's sake. And Susan started crying again and biting her knuckles. The others appeared in the doorway so instantaneously that it almost seemed they'd been lying in wait for this. Stem was looking surprised. He stared down at his fist, which was scraped across the knuckles. He shifted his gaze to Denny.
Out, Jeannie ordered everyone.
Then she said, in a weary tone of voice, First, we're going to clean the wound and see if it needs stitches.
Chapter 6
Abby felt nervous, at first, about the appointment with Dr. Wyss, but then she thought, I can do this, because I'm so familiar with my mother's Wyss pinking shears. And the exact clunky weight of those shears instantly came to her mind, along with the too thick handle loop that pressed uncomfortably against the bone at the base of her thumb, and the initial bulkiness as the heavy teeth began chewing into the fabric. But wait, really, the one kind of Wyss had nothing to do with the other. It was Nora who made the appointment. She had called her pastor for the name of a gerontologist, and then she phoned Dr. Wyss's office without consulting Abby. Meddlesome. She must have discussed it first with Red, though, because when Abby complained to him, he didn't seem surprised,
and he told her it wouldn't hurt to hear what a doctor had to say. Abby was finding that Nora had started to get on her nerves. Why, for instance, did she persist in calling Abby Mother Witchshank? It made Abby sound like an old peasant woman in wooden clogs and a headscarf. Abby had offered all her children spouses a choice of Mom or Abby when they first joined the family. Mother Witchshank hadn't so much as crossed her lips. Also, Nora stacked the plates on top of each other when she was clearing the table, instead of carrying one in each hand as Abby had been taught was polite. All the plates arrived in the kitchen with food stuck to their backs. Yet she criticized Abby's housekeeping. Or that was her implication, at least, when she blamed the dust and the rugs for Sammy's allergies. And she cooked fatty fried foods that were bad for Red's heart, and she was much too lax with her children. And that queen bed she had requested completely filled Stem's little room, barely allowing space for a person to edge around it. Oh, well, this was just roommate-itis, Abby told herself. It was rubbing elbows at too close quarters. That was why she felt so irritable. She told herself this several times a day. She also reminded herself that some of our connections are brand new connections, unrelated to our past incarnations, new experiences to broaden our horizons. Maybe Nora's role in Abby's life was to deepen and enrich Abby's soul. Could that be true? It wasn't as if Abby were a difficult mother-in-law. Why, look at how well she got along with Amanda's Hugh. A challenge, as Amanda herself admitted. But Abby found him entertaining. And Jeannie's Hugh, of course, was a sweetheart. Some of Abby's friends had a terrible time with their children-in-law. Daughters-in-law more than sons-in-law, all of them agreed. Some were not on speaking terms. Abby was doing way better than they were. If only she didn't feel so pushed aside, so extraneous, so unnecessary. She had always assumed that when she was old, she would have total confidence, finally. But look at her, still uncertain. In many ways, she was more uncertain now than she had been as a girl. And often when she heard herself speaking, she was appalled at how chirpy she sounded, how empty-headed and superficial, as if she'd somehow fallen into the mom role in some shallow TV sitcom. What on earth had happened to her? Her appointment with Dr. Wiss wasn't till November. Long waiting line of problem oldsters, evidently. Everything might have changed by November. Maybe her minor little inconsequential glitches, her brain jumping the track, as she thought of it, would have disappeared on their own. Or maybe she would be dead. No, shelve that thought. It was only mid-September now. Still summery, the leaves barely starting to turn, the mornings crisp but not truly cold. She could sit out on the porch after breakfast in just a sweater, gently towing the swing back and forth, and watching the parents and children walk past on their way to school. You could tell it was early in the school year because the children were so nicely dressed. Another month, and they would be making less effort. And some of the older children would have shed their parents, although Petey and Tommy were too young for that, of course. They had set out with Nora several minutes ago, Sammy leaning forward in his stroller like a sea captain watching for landfall, Heidi prancing in front on her ridiculous great long leash, three little towheads glimmering away through the trees, so non-Whitshank-like. Although Stem had been a towhead, so it was only to be expected. The boys seemed to have settled easily into the neighborhood, zipping their scooters up and down the sidewalk out front, and bringing playmates in for snacks. They told her that the other children called their house the porch house. Abby liked that. She could remember her own first sight of the house, back when she was a freckle-faced middle schooler from Hampton, and snooty Merrick Witchshank was her designated big sister.
That enormous, wonderful porch glimpsed from the street. Merrick and two teenaged friends lounging in this very swing, so casually, so stylishly, wearing rolled-up blue jeans and gaily patterned neckerchiefs tied in jaunty knots.
"Oh, God, it's the midgets," Merrick had drawled, because Abby had two of her classmates with her, little sisters to Merrick's two friends. They were supposed to spend a companionable, fun-filled Saturday afternoon learning the words to the school song and baking cookies together. But that part Abby couldn't remember now, just her awe at the sight of this porch and the impressive flagstone walk leading up to it. Oh, and Merrick's mother, sweet Linny, or Mrs. Whitshank, as Abby called her then. It had probably been Linny who supervised the cookie baking, because Abby couldn't picture Merrick doing that. Linny Mae Whitshank was pale and subdued, dressed in a wan, flowered shift that could have been bought in a country store. But something about the tracery of smile lines at the corners of her eyes told Abby she might be taking in more than she let on. Long after the big sister charade had petered out, Abby thought of Linny fondly. And then, years later, when Abby started dating Red's friend, Dane, there was Linny, as open-hearted as ever, stepping out on the porch night after night to offer homemade lemonade to all the neighborhood gang. Sometimes Junior put in an appearance, too. "Why, hey there, boys, girls." He'd hang around talking, talking, telling the girls they looked mighty pretty this evening and rehashing Colts games with the boys, till Linny touched his sleeve and said, "Come away now, Junior. Time to leave these young folks to their socializing." Both of them dead and gone now. Oh, my. Wiped off the face of the earth by a freight train, leaving not even bodies to mourn, just two closed caskets and no one but the police to break the news. So unsatisfying, so inconclusive. That bothered Abby more than it did Red. Red was of the opinion that instantaneous death was a mercy, but Abby wanted goodbyes. She would have liked to say, "Linny, you were a good, good woman, and I've always felt sorry you led such a lonely life." Abby had been visited, lately, by thoughts of all the people whose deaths she had been present for. Two grandparents, her mother, her beloved older brother, who died young. Not her father, though. For her father, she had arrived just minutes too late. But she had hoped, as she bent and laid her face against his, that there was some lingering vestige of him that would register her presence. Even now, sitting on the porch and gazing down at Boughton Road, she felt her eyes tear up at the memory of his dear, whiskery cheek already cooling. "We should all go out attended by someone." That was what she wanted for herself, certainly. Red's large hand enclosing hers as she lay dying. But then she reflected that this meant he would be without her when his own time came, and she couldn't endure the thought of that. How would Red survive if she were the one to go first? He always held her whole hand rather than interlacing his fingers with hers. When she was in her early teens, hearing from her more forward friends about the boys who reached for their hands at the movies, it was that enfolding clasp that she had envisioned. And the first date who surreptitiously threaded his fingers through hers had convinced her that hand-holding was not all it was cracked up to be. Till Red. Maybe she and Red could die at the same time. Say, on a plane. They could have a few minutes' warning, a pilot's announcement that would give them a chance to trade last words. Except that they never flew anywhere, so how was that going to happen? "The trouble with dying," she'd told Jeannie once, "is that you don't get to see how everything turns out. You won't know the ending." "But, Mom,
There is no ending, Jeannie said.
Well, I know that, Abby said.
In theory.
It was possible that in her heart of hearts, she was thinking that the world couldn't go on without her.
Oh, weren't human beings self-deluding? Because the plain fact was that no one needed her anymore. Her children were grown up, and her clients had vanished into thin air the moment she retired. And anyhow, toward the last, it had seemed that her clients' needs were bottomless, that society was falling apart faster than she could patch it together. She was getting out just in time, she had felt. Even her orphans, as her family called them, were all but gone. B.J. Autry was dead of drugs, and old Mr. Dale of a stroke, and the various foreign students had either returned to their own countries or else assimilated so successfully that they cooked Thanksgiving dinner for themselves now. In the past, she had been at the center of things. She'd known everybody's secrets. Everyone confided in her. Linny had told her, swearing her to silence, that she and Junior were their family's black sheep. And Denny had told her, offhandedly when she marveled at Susan's brown eyes, that Susan was not his. Nothing she heard had Abby relayed to anybody else, not even to Red. She was a woman of her word. Oh, people would have been amazed at all she knew and didn't say. You owe your job to me, she could have said to Jeannie. Your father was dead set against having a woman on the construction site, but I persuaded him. What a temptation to let that slip. But she didn't. And now she was so unnecessary that her children thought she should move to a retirement community. She and Red both, neither one of them nearly old enough yet. Thank God that had come to nothing. It was worth putting up with Nora, even, in order to dodge the retirement community. It had even been worth putting up with Mrs. Gert. Or almost worth it. Abby felt bad now about Mrs. Gert. They had let her go without a thought. And she'd probably had some very sad story. It wasn't at all like Abby to pass up a chance to hear someone's sad story. Amanda, she had said recently, did we give that Mrs. Gert any severance pay?
Severance pay? She was with you 9 days.
Still, Abby said, she meant well. And you all meant well to arrange for her. I hope you don't think I'm ungrateful.
Well, since both you and Dad were dead set against a retirement community, for some reason.
But you can see our side of it, can't you? Why, I bet those places have social workers to deal with the inmates. We'd be the objects of social work. Can you imagine?
To which Amanda had said, the inmates? And the objects, Mom? Goodness, what does that say about your attitude to your own profession all these years?
Amanda could be so sharp-edged sometimes.
Of the two girls, Jeannie was easier. Abby knew she should stop calling them the girls, but it would feel so silly to say the women and the men. Jeannie was biddable and unassuming. She lacked Amanda's acidity. She didn't confide in Abby, though. It had been such a blow when Jeannie had asked Denny to help out during that bad spell after Alexander was born. She could have asked Abby. Abby was right there in town. And then Denny. Why had he never mentioned that he had finished college? He must have been taking courses for years, working them in around his various jobs. But he hadn't said a thing, and why not? Because he wanted her to go on worrying about him was why. He didn't want to let her off the hook. So when he sprang it like that, just announced it after lunch that day, yes, he had his degree, it had felt like a slap in the face. She knew she should have been pleased for him, but instead she had felt resentful. One thing that parents of problem children never said aloud, it was a relief when the children turned out okay.
But then, what were the parents supposed to do with the anger they'd felt all those years? Although Denny might not be okay, even now, Abby wasn't entirely at ease about him.